This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Tedman Texas Jr. on the 13th of April 2002 at approximately 11:05 of Lubbock time. We are in the convention center in Lubbock, Texas, and this oral history is part of the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project. Thank you, sir, and why don't we begin with a brief introduction, when and where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay, that's not as easy as it sounds, but we'll go ahead and kick it off.
Okay.
I'm Ted Metaxas, Jr., not to be confused with my dad, who's a general, and I was born in Seattle, Washington, 6 September 1944, and at that time, we were in Seattle for a very, very brief period. And then from that, we bounced all around as I was growing up to basically one over the world sort of coverage. We moved from Seattle just after a few months out to New York, and from New York over to Germany when my dad participated in the occupation there. Mm-hmm. And then from there back to the States, Fort Benning and other places. And then for first grade, we bounced out to India, so I lived in India for a year. Mm-hmm. So during my youth and growing up, depending on what grade I was in a different country or a different school practically every other year for a long period of time. My high school first 2 years were in Germany, and my last two were up in Bethesda, Maryland, right outside of Washington, because my dad was in the Pentagon at that time working mm-hmm. for General Taylor.
Okay.
So I had an eclectic mm-hmm. background growing up, and you vary between Europe, India, and all around the States basically being New York, Pennsylvania, and Fort Benning, Georgia.
What year did you graduate from high school?
1963.
Okay. What was it like growing up in that type of an atmosphere where you're pretty much almost always on the go, always ready to move, always experiencing a new culture, a new environment, a new community? How did that affect you growing up?
Well, I think what it did first and foremost was it was a very maturing process for you, but it wasn't anything that was unusual because everyone that you knew went through exactly the same thing, and it's totally different than society for civilians where if you make a move, it's normally a move, and you go into a community, and you're the only new person there. Mm-hmm. In a military environment, when they had the bases overseas and had rotations like that, if you were there more than 4 or 5 months, you were no longer the new person, but the old person there. Mm-hmm. So as a group of people, you got very used to change in meeting people. Mm-hmm. And then over time, you would find that the same people you'd known 6, 9 years ago come back again. So mm-hmm. it's just like when you get in the military and cycle through various units. So it's a good parallel, and it prepares mm-hmm. you for that, I think, rather adequately.
As you were growing up, did you get how old were you when you finally realized that maybe the military was a career path for you?
I probably didn't think it was a career path for me till I got to Vietnam.
Okay.
You know, I'd say that would be pretty safe. And another thing the moving did, in addition to the cultures, it also gave you a good capability to understand different cultures and pick up their languages. Like mm-hmm. Mom and Dad were rather active after the war, and their little Futsfrau raised us, so you know, I spoke German as well as English just as a little kid. Mm-hmm. Didn't retain the skill, but then same in India, a little bit of the dialects there. So mm-hmm. that's something that gives you a little exposure where when you do get up and mature and go out, you're willing to try other languages and stuff a little bit more readily. So I think that was probably a mm-hmm. big plus also.
What was it like in India? What do you remember about that? How did they react to Americans there?
Oh, absolutely great. Mm-hmm. In fact, the friendships you make there, you know, been on my dad's part, not my part, because I was, my gosh, I was in the early 50s, so I was about 8 or 9 years old. And my memories wrap around the monkeys in the yard and living in the house with a dozen servants but no running water and outside toilets. And mm-hmm. we did have electricity. And the sense of community that the Indian Army had, and as well as the other foreign exchange officers, General Jameson, who was an Australian, was someone I knew in India as a kid, and then later had a chance to talk to him, and didn't work with him in Vietnam, but mm-hmm. had a chance to get up with him in Vietnam years later. Mm-hmm. And still, when we got married, he sent us something as a nice gift, and just talked to him about a year ago. So a lot of those contacts mm-hmm. continue over time.
Yeah. And how about that's the military relationship. What about the relationship with the civilian Indian population?
There wasn't really a lot of that other than the people that took care of you, mm-hmm. because it's a caste system over there anyway. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we were part of the military structure, so there's not a lot of interfacing, because like in Germany later when I was in the 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, or 8th, 9th, and 10th grade. Mm-hmm. In Germany, there was a lot of intermixing there because of the age. You could go down and talk to the natives and sneak a beer or do whatever kids did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where when you're 8 or 9 years old, come on, that's about Cub Scout time.
Mm-hmm. Did that happen? I understand in Germany, especially, and in Europe generally, there's really no restriction on
drinking. Oh, absolutely
drinking.
Not. Oh, no, of course not. I mean, and that's the environment. It's a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at McDonald's today in France, they serve wine.
Yeah.
I mean, it was accepted routine. It's not like it is in the States where you have age limits that are trying to beat something. It's just a different culture.
Yeah.
And you have to go with the flow,
right,
wherever you are.
Let's see. You mentioned Germany, India, other foreign countries that you were in as a child.
Oh, in as opposed to living.
Well, or did you visit quite a few? Did you travel
gee.
A lot?
Well, for example, just taking the Indian vignette as an example, we took a cruise for 3 months going there from California all out through Hong Kong and that area.
Mm-hmm.
Covered something like. I think that the total cruise was something like 63 different countries that we visited.
Wow.
So we spent 3 months going out, a year in India, and 3 months coming back the other way through the Suez and everything. So it was virtually one over the world coverage.
Yeah.
And in Germany, when I was in high school, for example, we were there for the 3 years. I was very active in scouting, and one summer we pedaled bicycles around Germany, Holland, you know, that area on the Rhine, and caught an old coal boat. Another summer went to England to travel around. Another summer, as a scout, went on the Mediterranean cruise and worked on a military ship all the way around the Mediterranean. Got to see all the ports there.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, it was, you know, very, very interesting and very unique. So a great opportunity.
What was the relationship like between American kids and German kids while you were there in Germany?
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
In fact, you have to keep in mind, when I was there, the first time, it was probably 46, 47, because my little sister was born there, through about 50, and then back again, probably 59, 60, 61. And during that time, and then I've been back many, many times over the years, it's interesting to watch how that culture has changed, because first time we were there, the Americans were the only one with anything. You know, there was still a black market going because they were just looking for the basic necessities of life. Second time we go back, the mark was 4.20 to a dollar, so that was relatively good. You know, and the buying power from an American was very good, so there was a little bit of resentment at that time with the German kids, because we had access to more than they did, but it wasn't anything significant by any stretch.
Yeah.
And then later on, when I went back to visit my sister living there with her husband, who was in the service, and my nephew, the rate was really just the opposite. The Americans were the ones who no longer had the economic fluency, and the Germans were taking care of them. For example, young NCOs sometimes live in German homes, where before it was just the opposite. You know, so the roles have sort of reversed economically over time.
During your times in Germany, did you ever get any sense of residual resentment over the defeat in World War II?
Not at all.
Hmm. Okay. Well, you mentioned...
Let me qualify that, because I could speak the language a little bit.
Okay.
And anytime you can speak anything a little bit, it makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
So as long as you make an effort to try,
they
accept you on a totally different plane than if you come in as just an American. And we have people that travel the world, stay in Holiday Inns, or the Hyatt hotels around the world, think they've been somewhere and seen something, and they haven't got a clue.
Right.
You know, so if you get out and get into the culture, people accept people as individuals rather than generalizations, and that's the way I prefer to travel.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents foster that in you, that interest in other cultures, other languages?
No, I wouldn't say they necessarily fostered it. I would say as a result of the exposure, it was accessible and you picked up on it.
Yeah.
I mean, things are presented to you and you take advantage of them or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the same time, there were kids, contemporaries of mine in 7th, 8th, 9th grade, who would no longer talk to a German and do anything else. They're very egocentric, very oriented just on the American culture. I would think it was to their loss, but you can't. Maybe by their frame of reference it wasn't. Who knows? Because we're all a little bit different.
Oh, yeah. When you were interacting with German people, did you ever get a chance to talk to some of the older maybe veterans of World War II, the German veterans?
No, I really didn't talk too much to them because at that time and place in life, that was not very high on my priority list.
You were maybe talking to young women?
Yes. Why not?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're only young once. If you miss it, that I hate to think I'd have to be doing that now. So I did rather well with that. Enjoyed it.
Okay. And the traveling that you did in Europe, did you ever travel very much into France or maybe make a trip across the Channel to England and that kind of stuff?
Well, that's what I was saying. Every summer, did that for multiple weeks.
Okay.
I mean, not just a little bit.
Right.
And what would happen then, I was a Eagle Scout, so I worked at Camp Freedom, which was a scout camp. So I'd go to the scout camp for half the summer and be on the staff there, and then the other half of the summer go out and do the other. So, I mean, what a wonderful opportunity it really was. But then we got to go over to England and travel around England, and Baden Powell, who started scouting, has a camp, the original camp there, and it was really great. Good experience.
How were you received in France when you visited France?
The French are probably the ones that are the biggest rub in Europe, and I don't think it's changed much. But I, at the same time, in fairness, have some very dear French friends. I'm talking about as a society in general.
Right.
You know,
versus your individual.
Yeah, that's right. And that's always the case. But an overgeneralization would be, you know, a Frenchman would only speak English or tell you he spoke English if he wanted to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where anyone else would normally go the extra mile.
Right. Well, when you graduated from high school in 1963, you were already part of the reserves.
Yeah.
How did you work that?
You're confused, I can tell.
No, I'm not confused. I assume you turned 18.
Okay, no.
Or?
You're young. What's October 20th, 1962?
You're talking about Cuban Missile Crisis.
Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
I was in high school,
uh-huh.
and the Cuban Crisis went down, and I wanted to be part of that, and I figured we were going to war at that time. The reserves would let you join early and then give you a deferment till you graduated. So I joined October of my senior year. The day after I graduated, I reported in the military for active duty through the Special Forces Reserves. And that six-month active duty period at that time, which would have been the June through the end of 63, was for basic, advanced, and then jump school at Fort Benning. And then since I had extra time there, I was attached to the Pathfinder Committee down there to work with Major Peterson, who was someone we'd known previously. So it was very interesting. As a young private, that had some very good opportunities, because what I was able to do then is when I started back to college every summer, I could go on active duty for a different course or different sets of training, so that it was like a part-time job for me. So that's how I went back one summer and had Special Forces training. A couple of different summers, went back, was able to have sniper school one time, mountain climbing school, stuff like that. So I was able to really make the reserves interesting and at the same time very developmental in what I wanted to do later, which was go for a commission when I finally got enough credits to get up to be a senior class sort of person. But that was a struggle.
Quick question, going back to your childhood growing up in Europe.
Yeah, when I said a struggle, let me follow up on
that.
Because as you pointed out, I graduated from high school in 1963. Mm-hmm. I graduated with a four-year degree from college in 1974. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that's a sort of a long course.
But you were doing a lot in between.
Oh, well, that's exactly what happened.
And
was
you went to Vietnam in between.
Yeah,
you were doing a lot.
Yeah, I quit college 20 hours short of graduating because of TED of 68.
Okay.
I was afraid what had happened at that time. I use the word afraid. What had happened at that time was I was going to miss the war.
Yeah.
So I said, who needs college? I can always get that later.
Yeah.
And I quit and subsequently was commissioned in January of 69.
Mm-hmm.
So that I could get to Vietnam, immediately volunteered for Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and made it over to Vietnam in 69, mm-hmm. and then extended in Vietnam multiple times for 69, 70, 71, came back in 72.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there that entire time.
Okay. I want to follow up with that and talk a lot about that. But before I do, the Cold War atmosphere, I think, is an important aspect of this whole experience for you. And I wanted to find out from you, what do you remember about when you were in Germany in particular, and maybe other places? What do you remember most in terms of this ever-present, ever-looming potential struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union?
Well, that was alive and well. In fact, during that same time frame, the Berlin Wall went up. Mm-hmm. And to have ever guessed when that went up, I never would have believed that in my lifetime that it would be coming down, and that the changes that have taken place would have taken place. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I was sort of a spoiled kid, I guess you could say, in as much as my dad was in 06. There weren't a lot of generals then like there are now. Mm-hmm. And he had the 505, which was one of the airborne battle groups, a premier unit in Europe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I knew a lot of people over there and had friends that we had lived with multiple times over the years that had moved to Germany. And also, so we were able to go to Berlin. I had a very good friend there who, Dad was in charge of the Berlin element. And that's about the time the wall went up, and we went over and we made an effort to get behind the wall, which we succeeded in, just because kids will be kids. Mm-hmm. And I won't tell you who he is right now, because he's a sink.
Okay. Well, we wouldn't want that on the record for now. Okay.
He's a hoot, too.
What do you remember about certain specific crises that emerged in the 50s in particular? For instance, do you recall where you were in during the Hungarian uprising? And if you remember, did your dad talk to you about those kinds of things as you were growing up, very much?
Not really, a lot. But I was very familiar with that because when I joined Special Forces Reserves in 62, our area of orientation at that particular time and place was Hungary. Okay. And we learned Hungarian, or tried to learn it, you know, at the time. So I was aware of what was going on there.
What group was that? What Special Forces group? Do you remember? I know, this is going back.
I honestly don't. It was 12th, or 12th or 14th.
Okay. Yeah,
it was out of the Washington area. Okay. And at that time, whichever one it was, it was located very close to the D.C. area. Fort Myer, I think, is where we were located at that time. Mm-hmm. And had a lot of paramilitary people out of the agency that were affiliated with that particular organization at that time. Mm-hmm. But then I crossed over and went off to college, and when I went to college, then I transferred down to a unit in Alabama, which is still there, right by Columbus, Georgia, and used to commute for that, and then used to drive back to Washington, D.C. from North Georgia and Athens to make the jumps and meetings. So we're sort of bouncing between units at that time.
Okay. What led you to Special Forces Reserve as opposed to just standard conventional reserves?
Well, that's an easy fix. I'd mentioned that we lived in Mainz, Germany, and all I'd ever been exposed to were really impressive young officers and NCOs, all of which at that time and place in growing up, if you didn't have a CIB with a star on it, chances are you were a putz, or not in that MOS field. You know, because everyone at that time, I mean, keep in mind, it's the mid-50s. They were World War II veterans, and also veterans of the Korean conflict. And at that time, I would submit the Army was probably as professional as it had been because of the experiences that they had, and also the development of those, both the officer corps and NCO corps. You know, so I think when I grew up and watched that, and those guys were sort of my role models, there were some very good people. And you know, airborne's a way of life, and you sort of get sucked into that real quick.
Yeah. When you were,
but that's why.
Yeah. When you were growing up in Germany. Do you remember in school and stuff like that, drills, going through any kind of drills for anything?
No, not really.
And of course, the United States.
Other than the proverbial fire drill, and I don't even think we had tornado drills. I don't remember anything along those lines.
Duck and cover drills, atomic drills, and nuclear drills, that kind of stuff.
I remember going through that, I think, in the States, but not overseas. In Germany. Yeah.
Okay. But you do remember here in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That was big time when they came out with the little bomb shelter scares, and everybody wanted one or whatever.
Yep.
You know, so it all ebbs and flows.
Mm-hmm. The Cuban Missile Crisis, before that, the Bay of Pigs invasion, mm-hmm. You know, what when these events were unfolding and these types of things were occurring, how, as a teenager, how cognizant were you of them? Did you pay much attention to that kind of stuff growing up?
Well, the Bay of Pigs and mm-hmm. stuff, yeah, you know, I got old enough where that was on my mm-hmm. radar screen, you know. So was very much aware of that, very much aware of the promises that were made that weren't kept as far as the air cover and stuff like that, which should have thought about that a little bit more.
And yeah. What did you think about the emergence of President Kennedy? And this, of course, there's a lot of mystique that surrounds him mm-hmm. as our former president. But I'm curious, as a young military person or a member mm-hmm. of a military
yeah,
family.
That was just prior to that, because yeah. the day Kennedy was shot, mm-hmm. I was in Fort Benning in jump school, and
right.
had just graduated and was pushing other people through, you know, at the reception center there.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, that was very real. And I thought even back then as a high school kid, Kennedy was very, very impressive. I mean, he was sort of a guy's guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he spoke very well. Was very much of a visionary when you look at what he talked about. And very much so, because keep in mind, you know, I'd already made the decision in 62 and was part of Special Forces.
Mm-hmm.
And so that framed everything I looked at. And as you know, wasn't shortly thereafter that he came down, General Yarborough, hosting around the Green Beret became
good,
something. Barry Sadler came out with his song a summer or two later. There was a movie by one of the people going out at the same time. They really had a lot of PR hype in Special Forces at the time. So all that was very much aware, you know, of that. At the same time, also aware of the initiatives he was taking with the Peace Corps
hmm.
and other things. And I think the thing that probably got the Peace Corps people to volunteer was probably the same speech that got the military people to volunteer, and that's, you know, about what you can do for your country and that sort of thing. You know, so I think he was a very effective and very dynamic person, and I think for my generation probably had a significant impact on, I would be surprised if not a significant number of people don't have any data on that.
Yeah.
But I would, just based on my experience, I would think so.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did you know about in, say, 1962 when you joined the reserves, and 1963 when you graduated? What did you know about Indochina and Vietnam and the American presence there and the advisory effort? Did you know anything?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
And the reason I did, remember I said we lived in India, that was the early 50s. Well, and remember how I said we got there, went out 3 months and came back for 3 months, six months around the world looking at different countries. But more important than that, when we came back from India, we went to live in Denver, Colorado, but my dad did not come back with us. He was shanghaied, or knowing him, volunteered for the Kashmir UN peacekeeping team there in Kashmir, and went out and sat on the border for a year there.
Okay.
So then the government gave him 30 days leave, and for his 30 days leave, he went to Indochina and visited the French army during that time frame. So his first visit to Vietnam was as early as 52.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that because we couldn't go, you know,
oh, yeah.
and I wanted to.
Yeah.
So later, when I headed up the project in El Salvador, I brought all my kids down just so they could get a good perspective of what a war was all about.
Mm-hmm. Did he talk to you much about what he did up in the Kashmir?
Oh yeah, not much. Sat on a rock.
Yeah,
that was not a high adventure sort of thing.
Yeah, it was pretty much a static defense type.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And as a UN advisor, your role is somewhat different.
Yeah.
You know, we used to blow smoke up my skirt all the time about World War II and Korea, and had a and that's something I hadn't realized until just now.
Mm-hmm.
But things get indelibly inscribed, and sometimes you never pin a tail quite on the donkey. But one of the things that really I had access to as a child was, if it was a weapon, chances are I had it or had exposure to it.
Mm.
You know, so I grew up around weapons, and at that time and place, it's totally different than the Army of today. Everyone had war souvenirs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up knowing a lot of the submachine guns and machine guns of Second World War because they were in the library at home. You know, so that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They were all registered through DWATS and all that, you know,
right.
Apple tobacco folks, and donated to a museum.
Oh, okay. But so did you get much time in terms of actually firing weapons like that?
Oh, no, there was no firing. You just, you know, other than, you know, at that time, the weapons you fired we were all in the National Rifle Association. They used to have a little expert. We could go get your bars and all that stuff. So every Saturday morning at Benning, you know, between scouting and the NRA, those were, you know, actively consuming your time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you hunt much growing up?
My dad did, and I was always exposed to it. And I did a little bit, but mm-hmm. not a lot. Mm-hmm. I wasn't an avid hunter, but I did some.
Yeah. It's okay.
What do you remember most about the Cuban Missile Crisis? And, you know, I assume that your father, what was your father doing at the time? And what information were you getting, do you think, that maybe was not in public consumption at the time?
Absolutely none.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you know, my dad was has always been a very straight shooter.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we were open whatever was going on. He was working for General Taylor at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And as he showed Ellsberg yesterday, that about the time I went to join the reserves, he had a card where he was supposed to leave his family and go up and be in the big hole up there in Pennsylvania in case of nuclear attack. But I hadn't heard that till multiple years later.
Wow.
You know, so, I mean, he played that straight.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it is incredible with what I've heard since.
Yeah.
And I think that's important for people to realize mm-hmm. that, because I've read several declassified things about the Bay of Pigs mm-hmm. and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the Russian ground tactical commanders had release authority for tactical nukes during that. If there was ever a time we came close, that was the time. And I understand also that the Cubans were very proactive along those lines.
Yeah.
Why put those things in my country if you don't want to use them?
Right.
You know, and then you look at what they exported later.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very tight time for us.
Mm-hmm.
But it just wasn't meant to be the time.
Right. And along those lines, just so the information is there, of course, there were actually tactical nukes available.
Oh, yeah.
Not just, they could have used them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were ready to be fired.
Yeah.
Your initial exposure, when you first signed up for the SF, you with the delayed entry, you went in. And why don't you go ahead and, if you would, describe where you went to basic training and some of those experiences, your first exposure to the full-time active duty Army.
Oh, no, they're
going to make it. Well, I have to try and I hadn't thought about it in 100 years.
Right.
I remember something, but not a lot.
Right.
The longer I sit here, the more I can think of, and it's
right.
You know, got to get there. I remember the day after I graduated, I went off to basic training and don't remember any of the particular details there other than arriving at the reception center in Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Okay.
And Fort Knox, Kentucky had Agony and Misery Hill
mm-hmm.
and a lot of long marches back there. And it was a typical training environment. You know, you got there and they told you how little you knew, and you know, you were lower than whale shit for all
mm-hmm.
intents and purposes. And that was back during the time. And all this ebbs and flows. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's back at the time when everybody screamed and shouted at you and were in your face all the time, none of which would work with the soldiers I worked with later, is even when I was a second lieutenant 6-7 years later. You know, I mean, things just changed. But I went through basic training in the Army when it probably had what I would consider a Marine mentality to it, for whatever that's worth.
Mm-hmm. The instructors there,
mm-hmm.
Do you remember if there were wartime veterans, maybe of Korea, some probably not World War II, but maybe Korean veterans?
Well, no, the NCOs were almost exclusively. I mean, if you if you were an E-7 in the military about that time or higher, or a captain or higher,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't infantry basic training,
mm-hmm.
you know, chances are that they did all have CIVs and were decorated along those lines. But that's something that, in growing up around that environment, I just thought everybody did.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, because our culture, everyone we worked with in the families as we moved from place to place were basically those who were so inclined, you know, being an infantry MOS for my father.
Mm-hmm.
That's the group with which we grew up. So
mm-hmm.
I grew up just thinking everybody did this stuff.
Yeah. You went straight from basic into advanced infantry?
Basic advanced infantry, and then was detailed for my MOS.
Mm-hmm.
And then
what was that?
It was a quartermaster.
Okay.
Because the special forces at the time, you could not go in directly without going, you know, as the special forces doesn't need E1s, 2s, or 3s.
No.
So you had to take a branch like that to get in.
Mm-hmm.
But it did then provide you jump school immediately thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of the glide slope that I had, because jump school is what I wanted to get to.
Okay. when you got into that, when you went through the advanced infantry training, where, mm-hmm. that was at Fort Knox as well? Mm-hmm. Was that okay?
Yeah, I think so.
Do you recall what the emphasis was there as far as weapons training and stuff like that? I know it's a long time ago.
Oh, no, I really don't. In fact, I want to say, I think we were all M14 at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of range firing and stuff, but I don't mm-hmm. remember the 203s or yeah. anything like that, you know, out of basic.
Right.
You know.
Okay.
I think that was a little later in, yeah. but I'm sort of blurred on what exposure was when.
Yeah, and you had yeah. a lot of weapons exposure before yeah. that. So.
And I took special forces training during the summers after mm-hmm. that, so I had a lot of, you know, interrupted, sort of an eclectic schedule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when you went in for the initial training, did you go to basic, advanced, and then quartermaster straight, or did you have breaks in between them as well?
No, in fact, I'm trying to remember if there's... I think the way it worked, and I'm not sure, but you could dig all that up. I think they had a basic course and mm-hmm. an abbreviated advanced course mm-hmm. and then sent you to, because if I remember right, the training for logistics was there at Knox mm-hmm. also.
Oh, okay.
As was armor, as was some others. So you went through like a quick basic, a little extended basic, or advanced in the basic, and then you went to whatever your MOS would be.
Okay.
But I don't remember anyone at the time where they went from there to the infantry. I think what they did was use that as a staging mm-hmm. for, you know, the other support MOSs or armor, which was right there at Knox.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not positive on that.
Okay. Now, when you went back, excuse me, when you went back, thank you, after the your initial training, what did you do between you were in school between 62 and 69?
Yeah, and in high school.
Well,
I was high school 62
and then
63.
College.
And then June of 63 to December of 63 was my 6 months active duty
okay.
that we just finished talking about.
Right.
In January of 64, mm-hmm. I went off to North Georgia Military College hmm. in Dahlonega, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Mountain phase of Ranger School.
Oh, yes, revisited. It's a nice area. Got to know a lot of the natives in there. They're pretty tough up that way. But I enjoyed it. So when I went through Ranger School later, it was back home week. But I was not much at North Georgia. I'll own up to that.
You weren't much?
Weren't much.
Okay. What made you decide that school?
Well, that's a good question. Not real sure.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I was not much of a student. And there were several options that were available,
mm-hmm.
and that was the one I picked out of those where I could go.
Okay.
You know.
Did you have a particular subject interest in terms of your high school experience? And
yes, the same subject interest I had when I lived in Germany was in high school.
A history or military?
No, young ladies.
Oh. All right.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
So I went to North Georgia for two semesters.
Okay.
First semester, I passed ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. Second semester, I took all the courses I took first semester. And other than ROTC, I think I passed history
okay.
that semester. So I became a history major. And I was wrestling with my dad at that time.
Oh, yeah.
As to, you know, I wanted to yeah. be active duty right now, go. He said, no, get a commission. So we were wrestling back and forth.
Yeah.
But after my second semester, I think I about wore him out. He could told me I could do whatever I cared to. He wasn't going to, you know, one way or another. But that was just, it was a hoot.
Yeah.
But then I decided to focus a little bit more and went from there because my grades really were poor.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I'm alibying by any chance, but I was also dyslexic.
Okay.
And never knew that until 1978
oh, goodness.
When I went to Monterey, California to take Farsi.
Mm-hmm.
And after sitting in class, the instructor after 2 days said, hey, Captain, you got a problem. And I said, tell me what it might be. I'm married. Got a couple kids and a pregnant golden retriever. What do you think my problem is? Vietnam vet? But it turned out I was dyslexic.
Yeah.
So after North Georgia, the only place I could go was a junior college. So I went to Barnesville, Georgia for Gordon Military College, mm-hmm. where there I finally decided to get with the program. So I went through 2 years and 2 years, what a concept, mm-hmm. and then transferred to the University of Georgia from there. Mm-hmm. And it's at the University of Georgia that I stayed during that time, mm-hmm. Got my commission through ROTC, and quit 20 hours short of graduating.
To get to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. During those years that you were in school, your father served over in Vietnam, correct?
Oh, yeah, 64, yeah. 65, 66.
Yeah. Did you have much chance to talk with him about his experiences over there before you yourself went over?
It's ironic you would ask, because I just recently, and I'm going to say recently, within the last year, went and found all the tapes. He used to send me these little reel-to-reel tapes. And would send one a month for about 90 minutes of dialogue on that. And we just gave one of them to the center, yes. and that one pertained to the boat incident, mm-hmm. and what was going on in 65, and I've got 8 of those tapes at home. But that sort of, you know, grew up sitting there listening to, like, fireside chats, sort of.
Yeah.
And then in growing up, we always talked about, you know, military and mm-hmm. World War II and mm-hmm. Korea and that sort of stuff. I mean, that was just commonplace.
Yeah. Speaking of that, back to the issue of growing up in Europe in particular. Did you guys go on terrain walks and things like that, looking at some of the battlefields talking about what was happening?
There's not a battlefield in Europe or yeah. Pennsylvania that we did not.
Yeah.
You know, my dad's idea of a good time would be go off to Normandy and sleep in a bunker and revisit, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, it's cool now.
Yeah. You mean you weren't willing to...
No, that's why I say at the time, and it's all relative, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, shit, here we go again, another battlefield. Having fun now, aren't we, Dad? You know, here in California, they've got Disneyland or something. You know what I'm saying? So it's all perspective.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I just had a great time with Dad. I wouldn't trade any of it.
No.
It was all... Yeah. I say that tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
You got to frame it where you were at that time,
yeah.
not where you are right now.
Right. But I guess back to the issue of Vietnam. When you went over, you had an idea, you know, mm-hmm. you had a perspective based on some of what your dad had seen. He'd sent back on tape and
exposure. And part of that too. One thing I think that was a real sort for me early on, because like I mentioned earlier, I was not a student.
Mm-hmm.
You know, never pretended to be.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went on to get my doctorate, it just. Why not? You know, mm-hmm. I got 3 masters and education specialist degree and a doctorate now. But I was ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
I decided once I got married and decided to have a family and settle down that needed to get the other to mm-hmm. get where you wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
So then it became very easy. But prior to that, I didn't have much focus
yeah.
worth mentioning anyhow.
Right.
But where I did focus and that was my field of excelling, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
was in shooting
mm-hmm.
through the NRA that I'd mentioned previously, but also through scouting.
Mm.
And make a long story short, I was an Eagle Scout at age 12.
Wow.
Had bronze, gold, and silver palms shortly thereafter. Was a scout instructor over in Europe for the 3 years that we were there in spite of my age,
mm-hmm.
because I had that, went on in the Explorer program. Got the Silver Award, which was the equivalent of Eagle Scout in the Explorer at an upper-level program, which they don't have now. They're talking about bringing that back.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Order of the Arrow and all that other sort of stuff. So
mm-hmm.
I had a lot of experience. You know, you'd ask the hunting question
mm-hmm.
with the camping and all the other sorts of things. There's a very natural crosswalk
mm-hmm.
between the scouting organization and military
mm-hmm.
operations. I mean, the structure and the system, you know, I guess that's probably why one of the reasons I enjoyed the military. I used to love them little pins and badges and
mm-hmm.
go anywhere for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I was young and impressionable.
Yeah. The training that you received while you were in college, as you stayed in the SF, in the SF Reserves,
mm-hmm.
If you would, why don't you talk about when you finally did get to go to the Q course and what your specialization was and what that training
okay.
was like for you.
Okay, well, I didn't go to the Q course.
Okay.
It was a different... that has changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through Phase 1 and Phase 3. Phase 2 at that time was the MOS mm-hmm. training, which was based on the functional areas of an ODA.
Right.
Remember I said earlier I was a quartermaster weenie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went in as a private and was a corporal when I went into the ROTC program. So I was... my MOS was that in quartermaster. Okay. You know, an issue out of the supply room working with that. With the cross-training and all that, you got to participate with the demo range and the shooting and all that.
Yeah.
It was not on an A-team during that time frame.
Okay.
Because of the rank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had to get there over time.
Right.
Well, so phase three was at Fort Bragg, and that was 65, and it was just like they do now, was a field experience where you went out and actually worked with guerrilla bands
mm-hmm.
and constituted groups and did...
You mean Robin Sage?
Yeah, it's equivalent thereof, yeah.
Okay.
And did all that. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. What about the initial school, phase one?
Mm-hmm. That was there also.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't, you know, it's the same thing.
How long was it? Do you recall?
No, I don't. It was either maybe 8 weeks or so, mm-hmm. 8 or 12. I'm not at all.
Any of that stuff challenging for you? Any particular challenges you remember, things that were difficult? Besides maybe some of the academics that...
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I would say that really it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go through, it doesn't matter if it's basic training mm-hmm. or advanced or jump school. I mean, you can look back in hindsight and say, nothing to it.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, given where you are and what your exposure has been,
right.
I don't think I've been to many military courses mm-hmm. that weren't challenging
mm-hmm.
in their own right, mm-hmm. except for perhaps the quartermaster school that I was sentenced to, and that's because I, you know, you have to know how big a pallet is and what the airspace is, but you know, that didn't
right.
tickle me too much. So
yeah.
I would say that almost everything I went through, I found challenging mm-hmm. at that particular time and place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that any of it was a bore.
None
of it I knew already. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you had exposure, but that just enabled you to get a little bit more out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I would say it was all challenging in its own right, given where I was and at the age I was, and you know, developmentally appropriate.
Yeah. But in terms of back to the academic issues,
mm-hmm.
because of course a lot of military training does involve mm-hmm. academic work.
But that's not a problem, or
yeah.
wasn't for
no,
me, because
no.
you know, where I have my problems basically were math,
mm-hmm.
you know, with numbers and
mm-hmm.
and stuff. So you know, I've always been able to do anything if I work at it. My only problem was when I was in college, I chose
right.
not to work at it.
Right.
You know, with the military, I had focus, and focus
right.
had been the key.
Okay. But with regard to your dyslexia, did that have any kind of a negative impact on learning, you know, things like map reading?
No, not at all.
Okay.
And see, I didn't even know I had it.
Right.
And you work out forms of compensation, didn't even know what they are,
yeah.
you know, at the time.
Yeah.
But it had absolutely no impact there. But not only did I have dyslexia, but my eyes are 420, 400. And it went up. That's one of the reasons I also went in the reserves, was the reserves at that time and place criteria was different than regular Army.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a waiver for
mm-hmm.
jump school.
Oh.
And I've always been a shortcut along those lines,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Yeah.
So I've always worked around that.
Yeah. Let's see. The other, how about if you would just, what you remember about some of the other courses you went through. You mentioned that you eventually were, did you go through Pathfinder training as well? Or
not at that time. I was attached at that mm-hmm. time. And this was, keep in mind, probably, I don't even remember, jump school was October, November sometime.
Yeah.
And I finished out, went home for Christmas, but just prior to whenever they broke for Christmas down there. So I was attached to the Pathfinder Committee and worked with them, not as a student there, you know, but they were running a class, was finishing up by Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw the last end of that, and they let me play with them somewhat, you know, just go out on their field exercises and dropping.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, what they were doing then was they were working on low-level extraction
mm-hmm.
with the AC-130 and the Caribou, and that's how you eject a chute. That chute then pulls out your load
mm-hmm.
for resupply, and that was a strategy they were looking for the camps and stuff for Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that's how they supplied a lot of the camps over there.
Right.
So had exposure to that,
mm-hmm.
but I was not a student in the course and didn't go through the Pathfinder course until sometime later when I was at Benning
mm-hmm.
and as an instructor with the Ranger Department.
Mm-hmm.
I think I went during that time frame.
Okay.
Or with Special Forces, I don't even remember.
Yeah. See, and you said you went through a number of other different schools as well, mountain climbing and things like that.
Yeah, we went in, and some of those, what they were with the reserve units, would also conduct courses they put together, a curriculum, mm-hmm. and you go out for a couple weeks with a different unit and take mm-hmm. specialty training along those lines. So that, mm-hmm. that was the mountain climbing. The sniper school was, I don't even remember, probably 4 weeks or 5 weeks. But what happened there, the sniper school was being conducted by I believe the 82nd Airborne Division, and they were getting ready to deploy to Vietnam at that time, and the majority, in fact, I was the only one in the class that did not deploy to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They were getting, Colonel Cleland was the commander that headed that thing up. Mm-hmm. So that was a very good course. And mm-hmm. at that time, it was very primitive. We had the old M1 with the M84 scope and a little leather cheek pad, but the weapons were glassed, mm-hmm. and we had an opportunity to just go out and really hone the skills. And it was an excellent course. But the thing about that is it's just something that takes extreme patience. And a lot of the training there is just not the weapon side, but also mm-hmm. getting in position, getting out of position, the camouflage, mm-hmm. and sheer patience. Mm-hmm. So that was one of my favorite courses. I really enjoyed that.
What kind of final exercise did you have to pass that course?
A sniper? Mm-hmm. It was, we had some maneuver exercises, mm-hmm. but that was the final thing was a sword on your scores. Mm-hmm. With your marksmanship and percent of capability.
Okay.
I don't remember what the cutoffs were,
yeah.
but I remember what I used to shoot with iron sights, I'd be happy to hit with with a scope nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, but that's changed, but the weapons have changed too. I mean, the M1 the M1 was a good platform for a sniper.
Yeah.
You could really reach out there even with iron sights,
mm-hmm.
where the 16 just doesn't afford itself to it.
Yeah. Now, at that time, did they have any silencing equipment?
In the sniper schools, we didn't use any silenced equipment at all.
Right.
But later on, and in Vietnam and all, and that's
right.
when you got into that stuff. But during the training phase, no. I don't remember any.
Or even subsonic ammunition or anything like that?
Oh, they had a special ammo that we used.
Match grade.
Oh, yeah, it was all...
It
was national match, and some of the guys, instructors, had some that they tweaked themselves a little bit.
Hmm.
But, I can remember, where you sit there and you watch your vapor trails.
Oh, yeah.
Go out,
yeah.
A long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
That was a great course. I absolutely loved it.
Now, during this time where you were going to school, doing a lot of military training in the summers, and... what kind of information were you paying attention to in the news about Vietnam? How much?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad was there. Friends were there, and we were. At that time, the focus would have been probably less because if, say, we had been in a military community,
mm-hmm.
it might have been different. Then I would have been saturated with it.
Yeah.
Because that's the lives people live, like I was saying, growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you're off at college, you're in the fraternity stuff and the ball games and all that other stuff, the focus was not there too much,
mm-hmm.
except for what you received in ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And ROTC, obviously, that was their primary focus and a great part of what they would talk to you about.
Mm-hmm.
In ROTC, I had one instructor in particular, which was one of the reasons I went to Georgia, by the name of Tony Herbert, who was the guy that wrote Soldier, the book,
mm-hmm.
and was the most decorated guy in the Korean War. He was one of my instructors there at the University of Georgia.
Okay.
Really good fellow, really tough man, physically.
Go ahead.
He and Colonel Hackworth were probably out of the Vietnam era, two of the ones that were very well decorated and did everything, but he ultimately broke his sword, or had his sword broken, no idea.
Did you ever know him?
Who?
Hackworth?
Oh, yeah. I've talked to him many times. He's a good friend of my dad's.
Okay. I'd like to get back to talk to you about Hackworth, especially his books and some of his outspokenness since...
Well, I'm not much... I just know of him and know him, but deal.
Yeah.
Don't think I'd have a lot to contribute along that line.
Okay.
A few opinions. I've always liked him.
Right. Mm-hmm. And while you're there at University of Georgia,
University of Georgia.
Yeah, University of
Athens.
Georgia. Yeah.
Well, I bounced around North Georgia,
right.
Gordon Military College, University of Georgia, and then later got a master's from Georgia State. So if it was in Georgia, I went there probably.
Was there much going on, especially at the University of Georgia, with regard to the war, war activity, that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. There were two camps on campus. Those who were willing and those who weren't.
Right.
No different than Texas Tech University's conference right here. And I don't think any of us have changed our mind much one way or the other since, you know. But that was an element there, as was a lot of other things as civil rights was becoming an issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a turbulent time for our nation as a whole when you look, you know, 65 through, well, I quit in 69 because I went overseas and left that stuff behind me for a couple of years.
Right.
But that was a very trying time, I think, for everyone growing up in it. And it didn't matter if it was a college environment or high school environment. I think, you know, our nation was really struggling with a lot at that time.
Sure.
And everyone was sort of polarized on their own camp, whatever camp that might be.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know we had the right one.
Mm-hmm. What about race relations? What were they like down there in Georgia?
They were growing, you know, I mean, going through it.
Yeah.
You know,
and
Georgia's, you know, at that time, never experienced anything along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I don't even remember, you know, if there were separate washrooms or fountains. I don't remember any of that. I do earlier when I lived in Columbus as a child,
mm-hmm.
you know, 52 through, or 56-ish,
mm-hmm.
or 55 in there. But mm-hmm. by the time I was off at college, you know, I think a lot of that had worked through. But I really was oblivious to it all.
Yeah. Was there a very large black population, student population, there that you remember?
No, I couldn't even tell you.
Yeah. And what about maybe classes that focused on Vietnam while you were there at the University of Georgia? Anything that you remember?
Other than ROTC,
yeah.
The only ones that were there, because most universities are on the liberal side,
yeah.
and there was one course, because I was a history major, ironically.
Yeah.
One course where we had to read the book The Other Side and listen, you know, to the professor along those lines. So he was sort of, you know, if Jane Fonda had been dateable, he would have dated her, I'm sure. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. How about Vietnam history and the history of Indochina and that kind of stuff?
No, not through the university thing, but my dad had a very good library, Bernard Fall and all that.
Yeah.
And in fact, I just cataloged his library for him this last year.
Oh, wow.
I have 5,500 books, and I've got them all by Bernard Fall and Vietnam. You know, I mean, hundreds of things that we've collected over the years, because I also collect. So,
okay.
You know, that part of it I was very much aware of. I was very, very much aware of all cultures and the diversity of cultures and the difference between cultures and languages, just because of the exposure that I had as a kid. So that was a plus, and then that's automatically reinforced, because that's how Special Forces is Special Forces. They understand the language capability, they understand the cultural dimensions, and train everyone. I don't give a hoot if you're a private or if you're the main guy in charge. That is the primary stuff that you need to take, understand, and believe in before you can be effective with any of the other. So, I mean, all that with you, you know, I felt when I went over was very comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming from a more unconventional training background, especially with all the reserve schooling you did, what did you think about the heavy emphasis placed on the conventional in Vietnam and the large battalion sweeps and the conventional operations and attrition strategy? Were these things that you gave much thought to before you went to Vietnam? Were they discussed much in our ROTC environment? Other military people you came into contact with, the reservists that you served with?
Not that I recall, you know, but I remember when I always tried the unconventional route. I mean, I went to Vietnam and went to the 101st, was my first assignment, which was just converting from airborne to air mobile. So, you know, I wanted to go there or the 173rd because of the airborne. So I tried, and I made a deliberate effort my whole career to stay away from the regular army and looked at either airborne, ranger, or special forces, which was more along my inclinations.
Mm-hmm. But even the employment of airborne assets or air assault or air mobile assets in Vietnam, but the application was still more along a conventional framework within the strategy of attrition. Was that ever discussed, whether or not this was a winnable strategy, that in Vietnam we were going to be able to kill our way to victory?
No, and we all got sucked into that body count. You know, how do you keep score and what's success?
Right.
You know, and if you don't define success going in, you know, the old total quality management, begin with the end in sight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shit, at the end we didn't know where the end was. You know, I mean, that was just missed by everybody. You know, but no one, I don't think, thought the body count was the way.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it, I think everybody there knew, because you really had to have respect for the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Because whenever I worked in the mountains or out, I can't ever remember as a platoon leader not going to a position, setting up, and having your people dig in where you didn't dig something up, where some poor person been out there, you know what I mean, before you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I mean, what they went through, their exposure, you know, year in, year out, you know, the malaria, the sickness, the diet, you know, carrying a round of ammo all the way down. I mean, they work very hard, and you have to appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe gave them something that we as a military did not have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like World War II when you went over for the duration, or you flew X number of missions or got shot X number of times and you were eligible to rotate. Well, they didn't rotate too much.
Mm-hmm.
But we got in that 1 year cycle. And a few people like myself, you know, extended multiple times there. But even I fell in that when I extended each time. I wanted a different experience
mm-hmm.
than I did the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I mean, I was able to be exposed to a wide variety of different types of organizations and everything there. But if you think of unit effectiveness, if it stayed in one place with the same people throughout that time, it probably would have been much more cohesive and better, if one knows what better is.
Mm-hmm. And when you said the pivotal point for you to make the decision to get in there as quickly as you could was Tet of 68.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
When you learned of Tet, go ahead.
Because I was already aware of Tet of 65, which is not known.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived through the accounts of all that and all the newspaper articles and all. I was very totally immersed in that.
Yeah.
And so we went from that to 68, and I thought, you know, can't be long now.
No, when you say that, what did you think was going to happen in terms of what was going to happen after Tet? When you say it can't be long now. It can't be long until the United States withdraws. It can't
closure.
Be long until the U.S. pulls out or wins.
Closure. Didn't know.
But you figured mm-hmm. it's probably not going to last too much longer.
Yeah, that I knew how in which way it would go or what would transpire. Probably clueless.
Yeah.
You know.
Didn't have a gut reaction on what you thought might happen?
Not that I recall.
Okay. After you made the decision, after Tet, when Johnson decided not to run for election in May of 69, I mean, it's May of 68, excuse me, did that give you an indication of maybe where it was going to go?
At that time, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah. Okay, you were already in country at that point.
Oh, wait, not May of 69, no.
So May 68.
I was 68. I was not in country.
Okay.
I don't think that had any impact.
Okay. Did that when you heard about Johnson's decision not to run? What did you think? Or did you think anything?
Nothing.
Hmm.
Probably. Yeah, I don't recall.
Yeah. Okay. And when did you finally you went ahead and I guess you in 1968 after Tet you made the decision you're going to go active.
So I was commissioned in. I guess that semester between September and December,
mm-hmm.
and then took some leave in December and reported on active duty in January.
At 69. Okay. And then you went straight to Vietnam.
In January of 69, all lieutenants at that time had to go through IOBC,
mm-hmm.
which was at Benning, and I have no idea how long that one was either.
Yeah.
4, 8, 12, I don't remember. I just flush all that stuff. But that was the first hurdle you had to go to in route.
Yeah.
And at that time, I went through IOBC mm-hmm. with a couple of my contemporaries from University of Georgia. We did the same thing together.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, when I finished IOBC, I went to the Ranger School, which was the best thing I ever did, I thought, as far as I looked at that as a life insurance policy for Vietnam, which it really was. But I also remember one of my most vivid memories in Ranger School was here was this guy going through with us with the CIB. It was probably the dumbest shit I ever met. I couldn't figure out how you could have a CIB and be dumb. But I later learned.
Okay.
But Ranger School at that time was probably the singular thing that I felt was, of all the things I'd experienced prior, mm-hmm. that would help me, knowing that I was a second lieutenant, knowing that my focus was not going to be anything with Special Forces, because I just a tent peg there, mm-hmm. but on platoon and patrolling operations, it's the best thing I ever did, mm-hmm. for preparation for Vietnam. I sincerely believe that. Mm. As I feel it's a great course, and everybody ought to go through, because all it is a psychology course that teaches you how you and other people react under real pressure. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they do that on multiple planes because everyone has different hot buttons. Mm-hmm. Some people can't do without sleep. Some can't do without food. Some can't do long march. Everyone's got different buttons. And mm-hmm. Ranger School is structured so that it can push everyone's buttons. Mm-hmm. And so that you, if you sit back and watch, can also see how people respond in different sets of circumstances under different stressors. Mm-hmm. And to me, that lesson was as important as anything that I got prior to going over.
The patrolling aspect and the training aspect of Ranger School, did it focus on at all Vietnam?
Oh, that's all it was.
And Vietnam-specific things?
Oh, everything. I mean,
everything was Vietnam.
ILBC.
Same
exactly. The mock village out there with the tunnels and the punji pits. It's totally immersion in 1969, any military training. There was no folder gap. You had to wait till you come back.
Folder gap.
Okay. It is totally emerged.
Okay.
And they did talk about culture and history and a little bit of language, but it was, you know, just enough to say it was there. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can't pick your language up or understand any of that in an hour or two. Yeah. I mean, you can be dipped, but then,
right. You know. When you got to Vietnam, and I don't want to talk about the trip over, we'll save that for later, but when you got there and then you look back on that training, how effective was it?
Ranger School?
In terms of what they were applying and what they were talking about Vietnam. How close were they to the reality that you experienced?
Lots of it, very, very realistic. And the realistic parts became in the villages. Mm-hmm. And landmines and booby traps mm-hmm. were very, very high there. Mm-hmm. And in Vietnam, they were responsible for a very significant portion of your casualties. Mm-hmm. And having had demo mm-hmm. and special forces, just a minimum exposure that I did, that was something, my comfort level was always there. And maybe that's why I thought it was so good, because I focused on that stuff, took it to heart, mm-hmm. and that part was really well worthwhile.
Okay.
It was later I was able to really refine those skills.
Mm-hmm.
So that part was all very, very effective.
Mm-hmm.
So after I finished Ranger School, then they wouldn't send you over. They had to assign you to a unit first.
Okay.
So I went to the 82nd Airborne Division, 1st to 504, mm-hmm. just in time to go to West Point to be the instructors up there for their summer program. And then, as soon as I went to the 82nd, I volunteered, and I don't even remember, maybe 60, 90 days was all I was there.
Okay.
Enough to say he's certified, go on. And, okay. and my West Point experience basically, or my 82nd experience basically, was Camp Natural Bridge up in West Point, teaching mm-hmm. tactics, of which none of the kids or students wanted to hear about. You know, I had a Ranger tab on, and they all want to talk about Ranger School, because that was real to them. And I had no Vietnam experience, so that was real to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the rest of it, they weren't too interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we went and we deployed and jumped into Turkey on a long-range operation.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on leave from Turkey and went to Vietnam. At that time frame.
You went to Turkey. Mm-hmm. You went to Vietnam via Turkey.
Well, yeah, we went. I wanted to go over there and jump in Turkey and do all that. And
mm-hmm.
I met my parents in Turkey, and then
cool.
I went to Vietnam directly after that.
Did you get your Turkish jump wings, or was
no,
that
it
wasn't
there,
a there jump
was,
with the Turks?
Yeah, it wasn't jump with the Turks at that okay. time, but it was an inland deploying and, you know, doing it was high speed back then.
Yeah.
So it was interesting, and that's an experience I didn't want to miss.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why don't we take this? This will end the interview with Lieutenant Colonel Tim Metaxas.